Going green is a very big topic here in Chicago. Mayor Richard Daley, now in his sixth term in office, is working to make this enormous teeming city the greenest city in America. Some of the policies Mayor Daley has pushed include a major effort to plant new trees, hundreds of thousands of new trees, and to turn the tops of urban buildings into green roof gardens, including one atop City Hall. We talked about that earlier today. Tell me how green is profitable for the city of Chicago.
Well, it's very profitable because basically when you talk about you can save jobs, you can bring new industry in. At the same time, you can adapt old industry with new technology and keep the jobs here, retaining and building new jobs.
This is a 2007 interview with Richard Daley, mayor of the city of Chicago for 22 years, from 1989 to 2011. The interview gives an insight into the perspective at sustainability that's been taken by city politics. Profitability seems to be a key driver for the greening of Chicago. But are there blind spots to this perspective? Is planting trees and creating green space the most promising way to make Chicago a sustainable city? Who's benefiting from this approach and who's disadvantaged? And are issues of environmental justice taken into account at all? In this podcast feature created by me, Julius Leibt, for the Rachel Carson Center for Environment and Society at LMU Munich, I will explore those issues. To do so, I have asked researchers and activists based in Chicago to share their perspective on the Windy City's approach to becoming the greenest city in America and the problems that come with it. My first interview partner was Winifred Curran, professor of geography and sustainable urban development at DePaul University in Chicago. She has researched issues of environmental justice and gentrification in Chicago for years. So what's her view on Chicago's politics regarding sustainability?
I think Chicago has historically been very good at talking about how good its sustainability policies are. That's where the name Windy City comes from for Chicago. It's not a meteorological term. It refers to how good kind of city leaders were at talking up their city and how full of hot air they are.
Chicago prides itself with being a sustainable city, a story forwarded by its mayors for decades. However, sustainability can mean a million things. So, which thing is it in Chicago? What idea of sustainability is forwarded by city politics? I'm asking that Michael J. Law, professor of sociology at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, who has published a number of papers regarding sustainability policies in Chicago.
The things that struck me politically were kind of like the aesthetics, like making it look like Chicago sustainable were really important compared to doing deeper types of approaches to sustainability. And so like in terms of sustainability, the United States and then the city of Chicago, I think is very leery or hesitant about any kind of regulation. And so the approach in Chicago was very like, we're developers, we're looking to put some cool gadgets on our condo development, we have the money to do it, so let's take this idea to the city and then the city will approve our like solar paneling, and then we can do that really quickly compared to other people who are trying to do other things.
Winifred Curran adds on that,
I think sustainability has become very much a buzzword, just like the term that people are using now to seem relevant and to seem like they're paying attention to anything having to do with the environment. So I think it's a very narrow understanding of sustainability that really does focus on the degree to which you can kind of sell something as being green.
To me, this sounds sobering. When I think about sustainability, I think of the fight against environmental degradation, about taking action against climate change, about creating a society that enables a good life for everybody while respecting the limits of the planet. But from what I've heard in Chicago, at least in its policies, it seems to be more about aesthetics and economic opportunity. It's a narrow, market-based understanding of sustainability, and sometimes a quite absurd one, as Professor Curran illustrates with an example.
Along the Chicago River, which has seen a lot of genuine ecological restoration, but not nearly enough, we're seeing a lot of really large developments that are just sort of celebrating the fact that you can see the river from them as being environmental, right? They're not actually engaged in any habitat restoration. They see the river just as another amenity to be exploited.
This capitalist approach of sustainability is not only occasionally amusingly absurd, it has real negative consequences for people living in the city. Because under this approach, sustainability becomes a luxury for those who can afford it.
The thing is that when you have that market-based approach, the problem is that basically those new gadgets that might deliver some kind of cost savings eventually are only available to people who can afford them. And so you've got big parts of the city that just don't have any sustainability amenities at all.
In fact, Chicago is a divided city. So divided that Larry Bennett, professor of political science at DePaul University, makes the argument that Chicago is de facto constituted by two cities, which can be distinguished not only geographically, but also by economic prosperity, quality of life, and demographics. The first city includes the downtown loop and surrounding areas, the north shore of Lake Michigan, and isolated areas south and west of the loop. This Chicago has flourished economically over the past decades. The other Chicago encompasses much of the west and south of the city. It's populated primarily by African Americans and Latinx, is economically disadvantaged and politically neglected. Bennett argues that this politically enabled disinvestment has a variety of consequences, such as a declining number of public schools, police surveillance and violence, and high crime and murder rates. To this, I'd add another consequence for the neglected part of Chicago, ongoing environmental degradation.
In the south side of Chicago, there are a lot of power plants that are basically impacting those neighborhoods and those communities and making it so that people are having higher incidences of asthma and other detrimental health outcomes.
Those environmental issues are the ones that really affect Chicago, or at least the disadvantaged neighborhoods in it. And still, the sustainability policies of Chicago, as we've already heard, do not really focus on fighting those kinds of environmental degradation. They are more about planting nice trees.
Yeah, we need more trees. We need to plant trees, definitely. But the problem is that a lot of times the efforts for sustainability stop at the planting of the trees and don't go any deeper than that and don't investigate the class-based, race-based, gender-based inequalities that are entrenched in the politics, the political approaches, the policies that have incentivized these particular types of sustainable developments.
Planting trees and creating green roofs does certainly not do much for those people that have environmental concerns. But at least, one could think it doesn't harm anybody to plant a few new trees or create a nice green park in a neighborhood. Or does it? To find out, we need to talk about gentrification. Gentrification is a process that can be observed in cities across the globe since decades. Professor Curran explains the basic mechanism behind the term.
So gentrification is always about taking land that had previously been devalued and somehow adding value to attract an upper income population that had previously abandoned the area. Restoring historic buildings or, you know, making public transportation more reliable or improving the schools was enough of a draw to bring people into disinvested areas of the neighborhood.
But increasingly, another strategy is used by developers and city officials across the United States to increase property values and gentrify neighborhoods. Greening in the name of sustainability. To understand this strategy, I've talked to Ian Hague, professor of geography and sustainable urban development at DePaul University.
There's always been a relationship between green space and high property values. Yeah, go back to Central Park in New York City or here in Chicago, Lincoln Park. A lot of cities have had this relationship, put a park in, and then the property values around that park increase. So that's not unusual. But I think what we're seeing now is the development of not just green space, but sort of high design green space.
There's even a term for this specific approach to gentrify neighborhoods, green gentrification. In Chicago, the quintessential example of green gentrification has been the 606.
The 606 was a disused rail line, which runs maybe 20 feet above the ground. It's an elevated rail line. It goes through the west of the city from Wicker Park westwards through a neighborhood called Humboldt Park, which historically in the last 50 years has been primarily lower income, Puerto Rican and Hispanic. And the 606, it's like a linear bike path, a linear park. People go walking and running on it. It's about 2.5 miles long. You get to the end, you turn around, you come back. But one of the things that studies have shown is it's increased hugely the property values within 0.5 mile of that elevated park.
Professor Curran doesn't have any illusions on the purpose behind transforming the previously disused rail line.
the point, and like literally the point of doing this, was not to accomplish any sort of environmental benefit other than juicing the real estate market in the neighborhood surrounding the trail, right? Where historically property values had been pretty low because it had been industrial properties, or because these are predominantly Latinx neighborhoods that had experienced decades of disinvestment. So if you build this kind of fancy new thing that you know people are going to like, quite literally is just a recipe for gentrification.
But to fully grasp the issue, we have to take a step back and ask the question, isn't green gentrification a good thing? Neighborhoods that used to be gray and disinvested suddenly get new green spaces, and at the same time, properties increase in value. Isn't it a win for everybody living there? Well, actually it isn't. Oftentimes, the people living in gentrifying areas don't benefit at all. Instead, they are forced out. That's because rising property values also mean higher rents for tenants and higher property taxes for homeowners. In the last months, those property taxes have been an especially pressing concern, as Ian Haig explains.
Every year, we pay a tax based on the value of our property. And the value of that property is assessed by looking at property sales in that area. And so what has happened in the rapidly gentrifying neighborhoods of Chicago is that the tax bills have gone up by 50%.
So for many homeowners, the increase of value of their property isn't good news at all. It's quite the opposite.
So you have a number of people on low incomes or fixed incomes, pensioners, people who retired, for example, who've lived there for a number of years, and they're suddenly hit with a tax bill that is thousands of dollars higher than it was a year ago. And obviously their pension benefits or other benefits are not thousands of dollars higher than they were a year ago.
Oddly enough, living in disinvested areas was, in some way, at least financially, a protection for some lower income people. At least they were able to pay their rent or their property tax. With rents and taxes going up due to gentrification, those low income folks oftentimes have no choice than to move out. And even if they scrape together enough money to stay, they watch everything change in the neighborhood as new, wealthier people start moving in. For the previous tenants, Professor Curran writes, this involves a loss of meeting places, neighbors and familiar services like shops, plus the nature of local social governance, leading to a loss of sense of place without any means with which to find a new one. And she points out that in a city in which economically disadvantaged communities are predominantly non-white due to decades of segregation and racism, green gentrification is also an issue of racial justice.
That kind of pattern of inequality, especially of racial inequality, that has defined Chicago for so long, is just being rebuilt into the environment with new tools.
With the city doing little to fight green gentrification and achieve environmental justice for all, people in disadvantaged neighborhoods need to take things into their own hands.
The only way that those folks could get anything sustainable happening is by banding together and creating a social movement.
Gentrification is a process, often spanning decades. Against this process, local resistance is possible. An example for such resistance can be found in the Pilsen neighborhood in Chicago's Lower West Side.
This is a neighborhood that has been ignored and overburdened with negative things for as long as it has been a Latino neighborhood, for sure. But even before then, because it's always been a kind of industrial working class neighborhood. So it was always an immigrant community and therefore not really a community that got a whole lot of attention from the city.
But as Pilsen is relatively close to Chicago's central business district, gentrification has been an issue there for decades.
Pilsen has been kind of under attack from various development forces since the late 1960s, at least. And so there's a real history of activism.
I had the chance to talk to an activist from the neighborhood, Paula Acevedo. As a Pilsen resident and community activist, she could talk to me firsthand about the ongoing struggles in Pilsen.
I'm concerned. I rent, you know. Am I going to be displaced one day? I have a son, and so when gentrification happens, it's not targeted for families, right? It's targeted for young professionals. You see restaurants that are so expensive or bars, and you're not even allowed to bring your kids.
At the same time, gentrification does not only make life more expensive in Pilsen, it fundamentally alters the identity of the neighborhood.
Everybody loves Pilsen because of the art and the culture And it's always ironic because, you know, as people move in and developers and investors and yeah, the people who rent or buy these things, you know, that culture that people love so much is not going to be the same. So it's very ironic, right? The same thing that draws them is what they're actually destroying by coming.
One could see Pilsen as a textbook example of gentrification. However, in a neighborhood, there's a strong sense of community. And the community has a history of fighting for their rights for decades. This activism has historically been about a number of topics, ranging from environmental degradation to education justice and issues of racial inequality. Nowadays, gentrification is one of the most pressing concerns, and quite often it's the green kind. Professor Curran gives an example.
So one example is Pilsen at 18th and Peoria. So this was, again, a formerly industrial site that has different attempts to build high-end residential housing on the site. And again, the city and developers were using the provision of green space as one of the selling points for redeveloping the site.
But the Pilsen Alliance, a social justice organization committed to developing grassroots leadership in Pilsen and neighboring working class and immigrant communities, took concern in the plans.
And the pushback has really been like, yeah, like we're all for green space, like fine, you know, no one's against green space, but don't make it a destination green space, right? Make it kind of smaller parks that are useful for the people who live there every day, but are not going to make someone travel from some other neighborhood in the city just to visit this park, right?
With green gentrification already being a visible issue all across Chicago, more and more activists in Pilsen rallied against the development project at the site. Ultimately, they entered the field of city politics.
So there's the activist strategy, and then there's also been the political strategy that one of the former activists who has for decades been organizing against gentrification, he ran for office and was elected alderman for the area in 2019. So when the most recent iteration of a high-end residential development came up at the site, he said no, right? And the developer knew quite clearly that there was no way that they were going to get it past him. And so their response was to sue the city. So instead of settling the lawsuit by allowing them to develop, what the city did because of this activist alderman, the city bought the site.
As of now, with the site being owned by the city, the construction of high-end residences is off the table.
So the city owns this land now. And so now the conversation is, well, exactly how much affordable housing is going to be on the site, right? Not whether there will be any affordable housing, but how much. And most people, again, is up in the air, but most people are pushing for 100% affordable housing on the site.
This shows that fighting back against gentrification efforts can be successful. But after every battle won, another one comes along. In Pilsen, a project similar to the 606 High Line is currently being planned. In 2016, the city of Chicago announced that a disused railway in the area will be turned into yet another linear park. It's not built yet, but the negative consequences are already felt, as Paula Acevedo tells me.
This is a sidewalk, a glorified sidewalk. And all the speculation over this glorified sidewalk has had these negative consequences for the community, as has increased the property values. It's ridiculously expensive to rent, let alone own, and, you know, lots of displacement.
Again, the class-based injustices created by Chicago's current approach to greening the city come to the front.
Working class families can't have green space like this. They make it amenities that only the upper middle class can benefit from these things. And so for us, it is a constant struggle.
The correlation of green space creation and gentrification can leave one hopeless. It seems that lower-income folks just can't have nice parks in their area. But actually, different approaches are possible, because green space and access to nature doesn't have to be created by city officials and investors. Sometimes the community can create it for themselves. In Pilsen, there's the El Paseo Community Garden, currently run by Paula Acevedo. Since 2009, it has been a meeting space for all Pilsen residents. And it's much more than just a regular city park.
We have senior gardening. Then we have gardening for everybody else, is referred to as collective gardening. We also have a wellness coalition that provides weekly programming, which would include yoga, sound healing meditation, fitness, flamenco. We've had grief circles. We've had Reiki. We have our permaculture site.
The list goes on. And not only people are profiting, nature is too.
It's also a pollinator haven. So conservation is huge for us as well, since we maintain a lot of natural areas and native plants. And we do have quite a bit of monarch butterflies, as well as a lot of biodiversity. And even a lot of birds now that we never saw before, because the site was a brownfield site.
The community garden is supporting people as well as nature. But in the end, it has an even bigger mission.
Well, our mission is always evolving. It's something like to steward, community manage equitable green space on behalf of the community as an incubator for community care and leadership.
In the big picture, and with the way Chicago's politics work right now, ongoing environmental injustices and green gentrification cannot be fully stopped. But still, small-scale projects like the El Paseo Community Garden can make a real difference for the people in a neighborhood. They can bring the community together, enable activism, and foster local coalitions that can become a voice in city politics. Certainly, in the fight for environmental justice and against gentrification, not every battle will be won. But, as we just heard, some can be. And, as Professor Haig points out, the awareness for issues of environmental justice is rising.
Environmental justice is becoming a huge issue now. It's been an issue in Chicago for a long time, but there's increased visibility to it. I think we see that in the change with the new climate action plan for the city, which has added social equity as a critical element.
So maybe the efforts of activists and community groups can inform another vision of sustainability in Chicago, one that's closer to Professor Curran's understanding.
A more kind of genuine, holistic view of sustainability that looks to be environmentally responsible in a way that also accomplishes social justice.
In the end, if Chicago wants to be true to its aspirations to be America's greenest city, it has to be green for everybody, regardless of class or race. Or, as Paula Acevedo puts it,
green space is a right, not an amenity.